I know Andrea's name. Andrea to me is a name that means something to me. It doesn't, you guys don't have any clue about. Right? And I know you all can say the same thing to me about names that you know. So it's another thing to know God's covenant name experientially in your handout, in the context and the world of an intimate covenant relationship. And so here's the key. On the one hand, we know that Psalm 23 is very powerfully experiential. Wouldn't you agree? It's a relational psalm. On the other hand, it's equally clear that Psalm 23 is not just sentimentalism. That's the counterfeit beauty. It is not just about warm and happy feelings. And so when I read Psalm 23, it's hard to discern sometimes, isn't it? Is it hard to distinguish between what's just the warm and happy feelings I like having and what's the real deal of the relationship, the covenant relationship? See, Psalm 23 is the expression of what it actually means. If you ever wonder, what does it mean to live in covenant relationship with God? Read Psalm 23. It's the expression of what it looks like to do that. And so it's only against the backdrop of the meaning of covenant that we can truly rejoice in the experience of covenant relationship. See, if Psalm 23 was just about relationship with God, it would just be sentimentalism. But Psalm 23 is about covenant relationship with Yahweh, and so it's not just sentimentalism. Psalm 23 is not just about a fuzzy relationship, it's about relationship defined by covenant. Therefore, the only way to guard against sentimentalism is to read it carefully and joyfully as the prayer of someone in covenant with God. We need to understand covenant then, first of all, in terms of the sovereignty of God. And so we're setting the background, the stage for this beloved psalm. Sovereignty of God. And this is in two parts. Number one, we don't initiate covenants with God or make covenants with God. Think about that. Any one of you want to come up with a covenant and go home or even stand up here and make it with God? Impossible. Impossible. It is God alone who can initiate covenants with us and make covenants with us. We're just sitting here powerless unless he makes the covenant. There's no covenant. Unless he initiates, there's no one here to initiate. Can you see that that's obvious? That's self-evident. We used to say, duh, kind of. That's kind of what's going on here. It's like, that's self-evident. And yet it's a profoundly important and wonderful thing. Sometimes the most obvious things are the most wonderful things to think about. That I couldn't make it with God, but he makes the covenant with us. In the same vein, looking at the sovereignty of God in the covenant, God doesn't make a covenant with no one in particular. You can't do that. You don't make a covenant, but I'm not making it with anyone. I'm just in general, and I'll see who ends up being a party to the covenant, whoever wants to, right? No, God initiates a covenant. And from the very beginning, God actually makes that covenant with a specific people whom he has chosen and called according to his sovereign mercy and grace. That's all involved in the very idea of covenant. You can't think of covenant without thinking of the parties to the covenant. There is no covenant unless God makes it with a specific named individual or people whom he has called and chosen by his sovereign grace. A covenant, that's a self-evident thing, but at the same time, remember, it's the self-evident things that are often so wonderful for us to think and meditate on. How did I end up a party to the covenant? How did you end up a party to the covenant? A covenant is never an open-ended affair. For a covenant to exist, the parties must be named personally from the beginning, from the get-go. So in Genesis 9, God named Noah and all his offspring after him as the one with whom he was making a covenant. That was everyone. In Genesis 15, God named Abraham and all of his offspring after him as the one with whom he was making a covenant. In Exodus 24, God named the whole people of Israel, Jacob, Israel, who were gathered at Mount Sinai. He was making a covenant with them whom he called and chose by his grace. In 2 Samuel 7, God named David and his royal line as the one with whom he was making a covenant. And then you can bring that forward to the new covenant. We'll do that in a moment. God enters into covenant with those whom he chooses to enter into covenant. You see, there's a lot that can be said about God's love for the whole world. And must and should and must be said about God's love for the whole world. But that is not the same thing as God's covenant love. God does not love the whole world with a covenant love. It's in that light we can rightly understand the mystery of Malachi chapter 1. I have loved you, says the Lord. But you say, how have you loved us? Is not Esau Jacob's brother, declares the Lord? Yet I have loved Jacob with a covenant love. But Esau, because I have not loved him, therefore I have hated Esau. I have laid waste his hill country and left his heritage to jackals of the desert. Now, that was covenant love in terms of the old covenant. In terms of the new covenant, God even brings some of Esau's descendants into his covenant, whom he has chosen. So there's two sides, but we cannot rightly think about covenant, guys. We talk about covenant a lot, as I said, for a reason. But you can't think about covenant rightly unless when you think of covenant, you're thinking of the sovereignty of God. And it's only against the backdrop of the sovereignty of God in the covenant that you can rejoice in the true beauty of Psalm 23. God has entered into covenant with me. I couldn't do it with him. He did it with me. And God did it sovereignly, making it with me by name, choosing me, calling me by his grace into this covenant relationship. That's the context of Psalm 23. And secondly, we cannot rightly understand the covenant unless we think about it in terms of the shedding of blood. And not just the shedding of blood. It's not just that. It's taking the blood and putting it on you. It's taking the blood and smearing it and sprinkling it on you. The application of that blood to all of those with whom God is sovereignly entering into covenant. So, Hebrews chapter 9. Not even the first covenant was inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment of the law had been declared by Moses to all the people, he took the blood of calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book of the covenant itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant." Yeah. We love to talk about Psalm 23, but talking about blood, for many of those who love Psalm 23, is a different matter. This is the blood of the covenant that God commanded for you, and in the same way, he sprinkled with the blood both the tent, the vessels used in worship. Indeed, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. So when it comes to the old and the new covenants, there's no covenant without the shedding of blood, and there's no covenant relationship without the blood applied to you and to me. We cannot rightly understand covenant, to sum it up, unless we think about it in terms of the sovereignty of God, I hope you see it now in the Word, and the shedding of blood. And that helps us to appreciate more when we read in the Gospels. Listen to these words. Jesus said to the disciples, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many, for those that God has sovereignly chosen by his grace." Luke 22, "This cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood." When we think rightly about the covenant, remember Psalm 23 begins and ends with that covenant name. Do you see how that takes away all of the empty sentimentalism? I could not preach Psalm 23. I felt I couldn't preach it unless we scraped away and strained out and got rid of all the empty, fluffy, worthless sentimentalism that has accumulated around this psalm. And yet leaving at the end of it the true, dazzling beauty of it. As you said in your handout, it opens up a whole new depth of meaning in this psalm. I want to reclaim this psalm as the birthright only of God's covenant people. Only of God's covenant people. Sadly, there are many who have drawn a comfort from this psalm that's empty and deceitful, because without the covenant, these words are empty nothings. They're warm and fuzzy sentiments, happy thoughts that actually are numbing us to the reality. Within, though, the context of the covenant, these words in Psalm 23, which we come to now, they express not in sentimentalism, but they do express so beautifully, so profoundly, and so simply what this relationship really actually is. So now I think we're ready. So the psalmist begins, "Yahweh is my shepherd." We call it the ancient Near Eastern culture, right? The days of David, the days of Abraham. The image of the shepherd, a lot of times people think of the shepherd as a lowly image. And in some cultures it was, but the image of the shepherd was a royal image. There were king shepherds. So Hammurabi, the Babylonian king, lived about the time of Abraham, and he called himself a shepherd. The Babylonian gods, one of the Babylonian gods, was called a shepherd of the lower world, our lower world. That's the pagan culture. In our inspired scriptures, which came from that same ancient Near Eastern context, the image of the shepherd is still a royal, in your handout, a royal image. So, the Lord said to David, "You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel." The Lord chose David his servant and took him from the sheepfolds. From following the nursing ewes, he brought him to shepherd Jacob his people, Israel his inheritance, as their king. With upright heart, he shepherded them and guided them with his skillful hand. Of course, not all shepherds are kings. But all the kings in Israel, the king in Israel was always to be a shepherd. And that was a reflection. Why? Why? It's not like God said, "Oh, you guys are shepherds? I'll copy you." No, it was the kings on earth who were to be copies of the reality in the heavens. God is the king over all, and it's a reflection of that this God who's king over all the world is also the shepherd of his people. So the psalmist cries out in Psalm 80, "Give ear, O shepherd of Israel, you who lead Joseph like a flock, and then you who are enthroned." How do you put shepherd and king in the same verse? Because shepherd was a royal picture. "You who are enthroned upon the cherubim, shine forth." So I would just start by saying, isn't it good to know that our king, the king over this whole world, is also our shepherd. Isn't it good to know that when we think of our King, you don't ever need to think of King only in isolation. You think of King along with the image of Shepherd, both together. As the hymn writers put it, Keith and Kristen Getty, they put it, our Shepherd King. In the verses that we've looked at so far, we just looked at three of them, the theme of the shepherd is used in the context of the flock. How many sheep is a flock? Is it one or more? The flock is more, right? And so far, the idea of the shepherd always assumes the flock, the whole nation. And in fact, everywhere else in the Old Testament, that's how this theme is always used. Flock, flock, flock. But we know that a flock is made up of individual sheep. And that the good shepherd cares not just for the flock. And I think that's where some Christians have struggled over time. We come to church, we see the big group, and we don't sense the shepherd's care for the individual sheep. Now, some of us are on the other side. We're so consumed with me and the individual sheep, we don't get the flock picture. The good shepherd cares for each one of the sheep individually. The flock is rightly emphasized in Scripture. Why does the Bible emphasize the flock so much? Because there's no such thing as a separate fold for every sheep. That's just like the necessity of it. You don't have a fold here for this sheep and a fold here for this sheep and a fold over here for this sheep. You have a fold for the sheep, okay? So that's why it emphasizes the flock. But that's not taking away anything from the reality of each individual sheep. And this is when I wish we had a singular and a plural for sheep, so I could say something different for the singular sheep. But I'll try to make that clear. So we read, not only is there one fold for all the sheep, but the sheep love to praise their shepherd king and follow him together. Do you know, I mean, the sheep doesn't want to be the only sheep following. He likes to be in the flock following the shepherd. Are you a sheep? Do you like to be in the flock following the shepherd? Psalm 79 says, "We, your people, the sheep of your pasture, we, the sheep of your pasture, will give thanks to you forever. From generation to generation, we will recount your praise. The Lord is our God, and we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand." It's the flock picture. "Know that the Lord, he is God. It is he who made us, and we are his. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture." And yet none of that ever undermines in any way the care of the shepherd individually for each one of the sheep in his flock. And nowhere else do we see that in the Old Testament. And it rivals anything we see in the New Testament. I think that's what one of the things that makes Psalm 23 so amazing. Nowhere else do we see this reality expressed so clearly and so movingly as it is in Psalm 23. Only in Psalm 23 do we have on full display, just the single sheep. There is the flock here, but it doesn't enter the picture. Okay, so all we see here is the single sheep. And that sheep's relationship to the shepherd. The Lord is what? My shepherd. Now the next blank is me, but I'm going to speak it in to you. As one who is in the bonds of covenant with God, do you think you have really yet fully comprehended how the Lord cares for you? Singly, individually, personally. Listen to what Jesus says in John 10, and I think the answer is no. I don't think we ever can. But that's encouraging because we can grasp it more. Jesus says in John, "He who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the gatekeeper opens, the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own by name." He doesn't have a name for the whole, it's not that he has one name for the whole flock. He calls each sheep by name. can you truly say, and I'm so serious about this, and whether the answer is yes or no, let it have its effect in you. Can you truly say, as only one who is in covenant with God can say, the Lord is my shepherd? In the Hebrew, the word for shepherd is actually not a noun. I try to bring grammar up only when it's helpful and special. We know what a noun is, person, place, thing, and I think there's more to it. But so that's the basic idea of a noun. Shepherd, we think of as a noun. But in the Hebrew, it's not a noun. It's actually a verbal participle. Fancy, but verb. Verb is action, right? So it functions as a noun, that's why we translate it shepherd, but it keeps its active verbal force. Fancy way of saying, the Lord is my shepherd, means essentially, the Lord is the one who shepherds me. Who is always faithfully shepherding me. He's not a shepherd sitting there on the rock, lost in his thoughts and forgetting about the sheep. No, he's the shepherd who is always engaged actively in the work and the task of shepherding me. Already, there is a wondrous peace and happiness and joy in these words. And I hope that having stripped from it the sentimentalism, the beauty of it is sinking into your heart. What an amazing thing it is to know God within the covenant as my shepherd, mine, as the King who personally shepherds and cares for me. That is something worth meditating on. Something that we are allowed to meditate on and even invited to meditate on for all of our days. I mean, this has been great because I just knew Psalm 23 kind of by memory. I don't know what I ever memorized it, but you just know it. But this week I've been meditating on it, and it's been such a privilege. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Now, if I know the Lord is my shepherd, then the result is I know I will never, ever lack for anything that I need. I may lack the things I want. I may lack the things I think I need. But I will never, ever lack for any of the things the Lord knows I truly, really need. For any of the things that are necessary for my truest good. Do we believe that? Or maybe it's a better thing to ask it like this. Do we rest in this? We rest in it. As we'll see in the coming verses, whether I'm lying down in green pastures or walking through the valley of the shadow of death, and you couldn't think of maybe two opposite pictures, in both circumstances, and indeed in all circumstances, I am able to say, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. To put it the other way around, I'm able to say at all times and in all circumstances, I shall not want. Why can I say that? How can I say that in every circumstance? It's only because it is true that the Lord is at all times, in all circumstances, my shepherd. So, are you seeing then how this psalm, and this is going to be a recurring theme now throughout, this psalm not only comforts us, but also challenges us. That's another way that we strip away the sentimentalism of the psalm, is by reading it not only to be comforted, but also to be rebuked, convicted, and challenged. Because it calls me to be able to confess with the psalmist, by faith, I shall not want. I have never lacked in the past. I know that I never will. Therefore, I am content. I am at rest. The Lord is my shepherd, and I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. The important thing for us to know here is that the sheep don't spend their entire lives in green pastures and beside still waters. The point is not that we live idyllic lives. You know, and this is where we have this problem. For the shepherd, do you think the shepherd thought about those places of green pastures and still waters like we think about it when we make our paintings of rolling hills and perfect sunsets and the willow trees maybe along the bank, and we just start, and it's just like this dreamy feeling. I mean, for the shepherd, that was real life. For the shepherd, that's where you need to get your sheep. It's just, you need the green pastures for your sheep. You need the still waters for your sheep. That's where you take your sheep. It was a good place, yes, but the point wasn't for us to romanticize it. It was what the sheep needed. So, the point isn't we live idyllic lives of never-ending comfort and ease. That's not true, we know. So instead, we think of the shepherd in Israel who would lead his flock through dry, parched lands from one source of water and pasture to another. The point is not that the Lord makes us lie down in green pastures once and for all and then leaves us there throughout the rest of our lives, but rather that this is something he does. If you want to know what kind of shepherd we have, this is something he does for us repeatedly, at different times, in different ways, over and over again throughout the course of our lives. That's why the psalmist goes on to say right after this, what does he say right after the green pastures and the still waters? He what? He restores my soul. Because before the green pastures and the still waters, which I needed for refreshment, where was I? I was in the dry and parched lands traveling. So the picture is that of having just spent a prolonged period of time in the heat of the Middle Eastern sun, traveling through often rocky and difficult, I'll call it desert land, so maybe not technically desert. And then finally, we come to that oasis in the wilderness. And I do remember being in Israel. This is a picture that I have, I'll never forget, driving in an air-conditioned bus through the hot and parched terrain. Until all of a sudden we came to what seemed like, and it's how it seemed to me, it was like a living, glowing jewel of green. Why was it look so living and glowing like a jewel? Because all surrounding, what was there? Just parched. And then there was this. It's an amazing sight. There was a stream that spilled over a little waterfall and then collected in a pool. And then eventually it found its way out to go on. And all around that pool, there was very literally the most lush, verdant green I felt like I'd ever seen in my life. The point is not that the sheep stay in those places forever, but that those are the places to which the Lord leads his sheep. And so, that he might cause them to lie down and rest and drink from the still waters and be refreshed. And again, why does he say still waters? It's not so that we can better paint the mental image of dreaminess. No. It's what the sheep need. Calvin points out that the phrase still waters expresses gently flowing waters. You don't take your sheep to the rapids that are rushing down out of the mountains from the rainwater or the melting snows. That's dangerous, and sheep, it's difficult for anyone to drink from that. So the point isn't how dreamy still waters can be, but rather what is needful for the sheep. Strip away the other stuff and bring in the truth and the beauty, the true beauty of this. The point isn't our idyllic sentimental paintings, but rather what is needful for the sheep. He restores my soul. My soul is not just a reference to the spiritual part of me, as opposed to the physical. My soul is just me. me. All of me and my daily experience of living all of life, okay? So there's no part left out. God takes you as a whole being, as a whole person. And he restores my soul. The shepherd knows when his sheep are weary and worn, and he won't ever let them faint or fall along the way. Instead, he restores my soul. We could say he revives my soul. Literally in the Hebrew, it's he causes my soul to return. So it's almost like my soul was departing, and God causes it to return. Always at those times when he knows I need it most. In some way or another, he is able to make me lie down in green pastures beside the still waters. The shepherd knows what his sheep need, and what they need he always provides at the proper time and in fullest measure. Do you see that there's a lot of room here for faith? Because we're not always at those places when we would like to be. Nevertheless, this is the kind of shepherd we have. He restores my soul. We can testify to that, can't we? And yet, we still have to live by faith. We're not meant to romanticize the scene. I think we can avoid that as long as we don't picture the whole world here turned into the Garden of Eden, but rather picture scattered oases, places of refreshment in the midst of otherwise drier and more barren lands. Once again, do you see how these words not only comfort us, they also challenge us? Psalm 23 is deeply convicting and challenging. They call us, these words call us to be able to confess with the psalmist, not just as a matter of our personal experience in the past, but also by faith. This is what we confess, and you can do it with me in your own heart and mind. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. This is the shepherd I have. He restores, he revives my soul. These are the things he does. He is a good and faithful shepherd. What about those times when we're in between the oases, when we're traveling, on, as it were, from one place to the other? Sometimes the journey may be relatively easy, sometimes more challenging and tiresome. But in any case, the in-between times are not the green pastures and the still waters. Is the shepherd still to be trusted? The psalmist answers that question. He leads me in the right paths for his name's sake. Now, I know it's maybe treading in dangerous ground to rephrase Psalm 23. But the King James, the ESV, the New American, they all say paths of righteousness, which can be right. But I think this translation, which most translations take, he leads me in the right paths or along the right paths. I think it's better because it helps us to keep thinking about the Middle Eastern shepherd and his sheep. It fits the context. So let me ask you, what makes the paths the right paths? What makes them the right paths? Well, it's just this. And I put here, next to my, I go through this and say, how should I read this? What do I mean by this? I put here, faith, Timothy. Faith, Timothy. This is the only way that we can ultimately say these things. They're the right paths because they never end at the edge of a precipice or at a raging torrent of water or in a ditch too deep or too steep to climb up out of or at the edge of an impassable desert. In other words, the right paths never lead to a dead end or to some final disaster. Final disaster. We might feel like it's the final end. We might feel like it's the impassable desert. We might feel like it's that raging torrent of water that cannot possibly be crossed. But the right paths don't ultimately lead there or end there because they're the right paths. Instead, where do they lead? They always lead surely, truly, faithfully, eventually to the green pastures and the still waters. We can think of that in a sense in terms of places of refreshment in our lives today, and ultimately the place of refreshment which we see in Revelation when the Lamb leads his own to springs of living water. Eventually they lead to the green pastures in your handout and the still waters that the shepherd knows his sheep need. The shepherd doesn't say, let's go to a raging torrent of water where we have to turn around because we went the wrong way. The shepherd doesn't do that. It's the right path every time. Faith, brothers and sisters, faith. That's why they're always the right paths, even if at times they're difficult, tiring, rocky, and parched in your handout. That's why we can always trustingly, confidently follow our shepherd, no matter what each path holds on the way. See, Psalm 23 has the picture of he leads. Never is it mentioned in Psalm 23 that we follow. It doesn't need to be mentioned because the sheep is talking. He leads me. What does that assume? I'm following. Trustingly. It's this following on every path, this following of the shepherd on every path in the midst of every circumstance. That's our righteousness. I don't think this picture is so much that the path is the path of righteousness. I think it's that I follow the shepherd and that is my righteousness. And I follow the shepherd in the midst of every path. And whatever the path holds and whatever life brings, I keep following the shepherd no matter what the path holds. It's in this sense that Psalm 23 assumes, yes, we're always walking in paths of righteousness. He leads me in the right paths, said the psalmist, for his name's sake. Oh, any bells go off there? His what? His name's sake. Covenant. Why does God always faithfully lead us in the right paths? The paths that lead safely to the desired destination. You see, where you want to get to, the shepherd wants to get you to. Only you can't get there following your own paths. The shepherd brings you. And so it's because of the answer, why does he lead us? Because of the covenant in your handout that he has made with us. See? And because he would always be proven faithful to his covenant. Sometimes we need that knowledge to encourage us in our faith. Sometimes it's so bad and we think, man, I don't know if these are the right paths. Is he shepherding me? We need the reminder that he does so for his name's sake, for the sake of the covenant he made, because he would always be proven faithful. It's not just our good and welfare that's at stake. It's the reputation, the honor of God's own holy and awesome name. So we see again, this psalm not only comforts us, it challenges us to be able to pray these words by faith. Okay? Can we pray these words by faith? He leads me in the what paths? The right paths. That's hard to say sometimes. You can only say it by faith. The right paths. For his name's sake. I know this to be true. And so I can always trustingly, confidently, in full obedience and submission, follow my shepherd. Really? Really? Always? Well, the psalmist answers that in verse 4. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. The right paths? That sounds all fine, and as long as they're not too bad, I think I could call them the right paths. I know where they're going. But the right paths in which our shepherd leads us may even be paths that pass through, not to, but through the valley of the shadow of death. I think that's important. Notice the psalmist doesn't say, even though I walk to the valley of the shadow of death, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, though it may not feel that way, like there is a through. But do we comprehend that? Are we able to confess by faith that even these paths that pass through the valley of the shadow of death, they're still the what paths? They're still the right paths. And therefore, they are never, under any circumstances, to be abandoned for any other paths, no matter how easy they may be. Shadow of death. Again, I mean, this psalm has been so romanticized, we almost romanticized the valley of the shadow of death, in a sense. But this is a single word in the Hebrew, it's not two words. And so we get shadow of death by dividing up one word into two words. I think maybe a better way to give the sense of the meaning would be to do what other translations do. Or we could say this, it's the valley of death shade. Or the valley of deathly shadow. So in other words, this isn't just about literal death and dying. This isn't just a psalm for funerals, right? It's about a valley that's deathly dark. It's a way of expressing the terrors of this valley. The terrors of it. In other words, well, that's why many translations say, even though I walk through the darkest valley. One commentator describes what the psalmist has in mind here. The hill country of Judah is broken up by narrow and precipitous ravines or wadis, difficult to descend and ascend, dark and gloomy because they're cut off from the light by the steep sides of the ravines, and abounding in caves, which could be the abode of wild beasts, of robbers. When I hear of a valley, I automatically just feel like something nice. Perhaps we ought to say, you know, instead of this gentle and lush river valley that's dark nevertheless and deathly, this is the deep and treacherous ravine. So I ask you, what's the darkest valley for us? Now, at some point, it may be literal death. That's not excluded here, but more generally, the darkest valley is whatever circumstances may cause us at any time to be the most, what? Most afraid. The most fearful. We know what that is. We can identify. None of us are past fear. There may be, on the one hand, if you look at the imagery we can use, there may be the more sinister threats and dangers from outside, like the robbers and the wild beasts in the caves, or just the more innocent but no less terrible threat of losing my way and being left alone to fend for myself in this terrifying valley. Right? But in either case, the psalmist says he is firm. He is settled in his faith. And so what does he say? I will fear no evil. No danger of any kind. Even though they are terrifying and fearful, I will fear no evil. Why? Why? In a sense, I feel like this is the high point of the psalm. For you are with me. For you are with me. Those are some of the most wonderful, beautiful words in all of Scripture. I'm not exaggerating. I'm not saying it just for effect. I mean it. Think of the Emmanuel, God with us. Can we pray those words by faith, even when we're in the deepest, darkest valley? So what we have here is yet another reminder. Remember the sentimentalism that we're getting rid of? This "you are with me" is the definition of covenant. He is with only those with whom he's entered into covenant, and yet he is always faithfully with those whom he has entered into covenant with. Here's another reminder of that covenant, because in Exodus, when God revealed himself to his people and he said, here's my name, and this is now my covenant name, Yahweh, which means I was, I am, I will be. He did that, he revealed that name against the backdrop of his promise to Moses in just the previous verse, in which he said to Moses, I will be with you. That's covenant. So as those who are in covenant with God, as those who have been chosen by God, and maybe instead of the flock, those, let me say, as one who has been chosen by God, who has had the blood of the covenant applied to me, as one who knows his name, I love to say, and I delight to say at all times and all circumstances, for you are with me. He is with me, not just to be with me. Why is someone's presence comforting? He's with me to protect me, to guard me from all the dangers that lurk, with his rod that strikes and smites the enemy, the danger, and also to guide me and to keep me in the right path with his staff. And so the psalmist says, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Now, it's important to see here, it's not actually the rod or the staff in and of itself that comforts the sheep, is it? If I saw the staff laying on the ground, would that staff comfort me? Of course not. The rod? No. It's the fact that it's your rod and it's your staff. And so the rod and the staff comfort the sheep only insofar as these things stand in for this metonymy. They're standing in for something. The rod and the staff stand in for the protecting, guiding presence of the shepherd. To say, your rod and your staff, they comfort me, is just another way of saying, a beautiful way of saying, for you are with me, you comfort me with your presence. What we have in these verses is a prayer that truly does encapsulate. It just gathers everything up and encapsulates it. The nature of that relationship that exists between the covenant God and his covenant child. It's one thing to know about covenant relationship. It's another thing to be in one. This is a relationship that is pictured for us in terms of a shepherd and a sheep. Of a shepherd who calls each one of his sheep by name, cares for each one of his sheep individually. And this is a picture, on the one hand, of the most tender care. And on the other hand, of the most implicit, what? What is it here? Trust. The shepherd leads, the sheep follow. And so, as we've seen over and over again already this morning, this psalm is not just a psalm of comfort, though it is that. It is. But it is also a psalm that I am challenged, deeply challenged, to pray and to sing by faith. Because there is a level, there is a point, where that is the only way to pray and to sing this psalm is by faith, as the expression of my implicit trust in my shepherd. And it's as I pray and sing this psalm by faith, as one who is in covenant with God's sovereignty, the blood applied to me, that I can then enter in to all of the genuine comforts and delights that are here to be enjoyed. At the end of the day, we are called to enjoy the delights, the comforts of this psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the right paths for His name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for You are with me. Your rod and Your staff, they comfort me.